I'm Kate Koff. Welcome to The Weekly. It's summer in Maine, and everyone is anxious to enjoy the outdoors. State and national parks are expecting record numbers of visitors this year. It's likely that Acadia National Park alone will see close to 3.5 million people come to hike on its trails, bike the carriage roads, and watch the sunrise on Cadillac Mountain. But visitors who come to Acadia this summer will find a park that looks quite different than it did 100 years ago. Climate change and human impact have altered the landscape in subtle and not so subtle ways. We've built roads and trails, of course, but our actions have also changed the kinds of plants, animals, and birds that call the park home. In early June, I sat down with Kevin Schneider, the park superintendent, and Abe Miller-Rushing, the park science coordinator, to talk about what Acadia might look like in another 50 years, and how we have the difficult conversations about when to resist ecological changes, when to accept them, and when to direct them. As always, our email is theweekly@villagesoup.com.
We know the climate's changing. There is no, you know, doubt about that from a scientific perspective.
Kevin Schneider.
The question is, how much is it changing? Is it 2 degrees, 4 degrees C? Is it more than that? And then we also are seeing that the climate is going to be wetter here. And it's going to be less in the form of snow and more in the form of rain in the winter.
And the rain that is falling in more intense storms, said Abe Miller-Rushing.
So we're getting bigger rainstorms. Just the other day, we had the 4 inches of rain in 6 hours that washed out carriage roads and motor roads as well. In a lot of places, and those kind of events are becoming more common. We're actually getting more rain each year here, and actually less snow also. More of our, you know, what used to be snow is falling as rain. We're seeing rising sea levels and bigger, more damage from storm surges. We're seeing ocean acidification. So the ocean pH is getting more acidic, which is a problem for anything that has a shell. And so those are some of the, you know, there are other things like invasive species that a lot of our invasive plants and insect pests that are here because it's warmer and they can take advantage of the plants can take advantage of our longer growing season. And the insects are able to expand their range here. So these are a lot of the challenges that are kind of climate change related, and there are others as well. It's creating a quandary for us to how do we shift how we manage the park.
Since they're not exactly sure what kind of changes shifting temperatures will bring, park officials work with several different scenarios to imagine the future in Acadia.
Well, what if the scenario is 2 degrees C warmer with an additional, you know, X amount of precipitation? What if it's 4 degrees C? And when change in precipitation. And so we can sort of evaluate like what if in each of those scenarios. So we're not sort of trying to predict exactly what scenario is going to play out, but we've pre-planned and thought about, you know, what are our management actions based on those different scenarios. So the Park Service is also using a framework that we're calling the RAD framework, which is resist, accept, and direct, to think about how do we sort of adjust our management in the face of climate change. So let me give you an example, a place like Thunder Hole. Thunder Hole is one of those iconic locations in Acadia. Many people come here and they've gone there as a child and now they're bringing their kids to Thunder Hole. And yet it's an investment. You know, we have a sidewalk, we have a handrail, and at an increasing frequency, the ocean is sort of gobbling up Thunder Hole and tearing those assets apart. And so at what point do we give up on Thunder Hole and say, you know what, we're not going to build a walkway out to that point. We're not going to put a handrail in. It just becomes sort of a fool's errand to keep rebuilding it every 2 or 3 years instead of every 20 years, as may have been the case in the past. I think that sort of points to like some of those difficult challenges. Like that is an iconic location. People want to get out there. We want them to be able to get out there safely. And so, you know, how do we manage in that framework?
That framework is a big deviation from the way Acadia and all national parks were previously managed. Abe Miller-Rushing.
I mean, an important thing to recognize is the National Park Service, kind of when we were founded, was set up to really keep things the same as they were. You know, a lot of national parks aimed to keep things at pre-European contact kind of conditions. And we now know that that's not possible, that the park is changing. And, you know, already here in Acadia, for instance, one out of every six of the plant species that were here 100 years ago have disappeared. We already know we're failing at keeping things as, and it was an impossible thing at the beginning. We now are thinking about how to manage that change, which is a big shift for how the National Park Service approaches things. And some of the scenarios that we're looking at are kind of rapid changes in temperature or rapid changes in precipitation. We're actually looking at both preparing for bigger storms, but also potentially more drought. You know, what we're, and it's impossible to predict the future, right? And so what we're trying to do is set up, work with climate scientists to set up these models about what is plausible, different plausible futures, because we don't know which one it'll be. And how can we plan for those? What are the kind of thing management actions that work across all of the scenarios? And what are the things that maybe are low likelihood, but have a high risk to damage resources that we ought to also be prepared for so we're not caught off guard?
One scenario the park is looking at is how to plan for the possible loss of the spruce fir forest, which expands far north into Canada. Spruce fir doesn't tolerate drought well, and Acadia is close to the southern end of the range for this kind of forest, said Abe Miller-Rushing. Scientists are concerned that, without active management, invasive plants might choke out the spruce fir forest.
We're looking at, okay, well, what tree species are native here, yet are the species that are more likely to be adapted to a changing climate? And so they may be species that are found further south than here, but are also, maybe this is the northern end of their range, versus tree species like the red spruce, which is iconic on the main coast, but it may not be in 60 or 70 years. That may not be the dominant tree species like it is now, that we're sort of at the southern end of its range. So, you know, there is incredible change taking place, and that is sort of how we think about this. And, you know, we're fortunate that we have a really strong science program to help think about climate change. You know, when I went to college, I did not really learn about climate change, although I got a degree in natural resources and park management. But that wasn't what was taught when I was in college, and I was not in college all that long ago. And now, if we look at our sort of the research that's occurring in Acadia, there are about 70 to 80 research projects annually that are done in Acadia by people from all over the country, from universities, and so on. And something like 75% of that research is focused on climate change kind of themes, the majority of it. Again, 10 or 15 years ago, that would have been a much smaller figure. So there's just tremendous science that's taking place. And it's really valuable to us as park managers to be able to better understand sort of what's going to happen in the future and how do we manage appropriately? Where is it appropriate to resist, accept, or direct change?
To help figure out which species might one day be at home in Acadia, scientists at the Skudik Institute have set up tree test beds with tree species from further south, oaks, hickories, and southern pine, alongside native species to see how they grow together. Abe Miller-Rushing.
Which species can survive and which species do too well and might become invasive up here? And how can we identify those kind of characteristics so that we can start getting information about if we do want to help some species move up north into the park, which is a technique called managed relocation? How can we do that smartly in a way that we're not going to regret later on? Because we definitely do know that we will, you know, conservation managers over all of time have made some decisions that we come to regret later. And what we're trying to do is do the science right now that helps us fail early and fast and small. And so that when we scale up our restoration projects, that we can be smart about what we're doing.
So what would happen if park officials did no resisting or directing? It's likely Acadia would end up looking like a thicket of invasive species, like Japanese barberry and glossy buckthorn. There might be some southern tree species in there as well, but there are a lot of obstacles to them getting here. Deciding when to resist and direct change, said Miller-Rushing, is a decision communities, scientists, and park officials must make together.
In part, that comes down to the value questions about what do we want our forests to look like if we're thinking about other ecosystems. What do we consider a healthy ecosystem. You know, if we don't take action and if we let it go, what we're pretty confident will happen here is that the invasive shrubs like glossy buckthorn or Japanese barberry or these other species will spread and choke out the regeneration of new young forest. And we can already see this happening in national parks to our south. They're forests where they're not actively managing these invasive species. They're getting choked out by, you know, these invasive species are doing too well and are choking out. There are no native trees able to grow. What we would end up with is an invasive kind of thicket, you know, which most people aren't excited about that. And I think that's not an ecosystem that we're particularly excited about having. And certainly it would also damage species from our south that we would normally be shifting up here. They would be running into another barrier that they wouldn't be able to pass because they wouldn't necessarily be able to grow in this kind of in the shrubland. But at the end of the day, in large part, it becomes a value judgment. And so we're having those conversations about what do we want going forward. And at the moment, we're less excited about having a thicket of invasive plants. And we're more excited about having, you know, facilitating a shift to hardwood, oaks and hickories when that time comes.
There is also, of course, the issue of infrastructure. The park has 45 miles of packed gravel carriage roads, as well as motor roads that see millions of visitors each year. Cars and trucks have gotten heavier since the roads were built, and rainstorms have gotten bigger. The park has more than 1,000 culverts, nearly all of which are too small, said Miller Rushing, and it had roughly $66 million in deferred maintenance in 2018.
We know that as we're addressing deferred maintenance, we have to be thinking about climate change and not just replacing it as it was in the past, but replacing it to be able to handle conditions going into the future.
One of the major projects this year is rehabilitation of the Eagle Lake Loop, a roughly 6-mile stretch that's one of the most popular in the park.
It's the only section of carriage roads back in the 90s when they were originally sort of rehabilitated. It was the only section that didn't get that rehabilitation. And so while it sort of might look fine to a casual, you know, person out there, there's underlying sort of features and drainage structures that really needed to be rebuilt. And so that's what's taking place right now. And unfortunately, while it's being rebuilt, the loop is closed right now. It will reopen gradually as, you know, segments are finished. And so hopefully, you know, in July, we'll start to see some of the segments reopen. Anything we do that's a rehabilitation like that, we're looking at it from a climate perspective. So, you know, for example, on the carriage roads, someone had asked me, why did the Witch Hole section of the carriage roads in the park reopen earlier this year than the rest of the carriage road system? You know, normally our carriage roads close for mud season. And the answer to that question is actually because it's climate related at some level. It's because of the nature of the storm events that we're seeing over the winter. On the Witch Hole carriage road section, our carriage road crew was able to get out and do some work with the canopy of the trees to minimize the drainage and the storm events occurring on the carriage roads. And that preservation work actually allowed them to dry out faster and consequently reopen earlier. And so anything we do in the park from a facility investment standpoint has sort of that climate lens. Like Cromwell Brook, we're rebuilding a culvert under Park Loop Road to allow for that wetland to drain more effectively. And it's a bigger sort of supersized culvert. That's kind of just the basic gist of what we're doing.
Abe Miller Rushing.
Like one of the most unsexy things to think about when you're doing resource management, these like pipes under roads and trails and things. We have over 1,000 of them in Acadia, and almost all of them are too small. And rainfall events like that really show what happens when you have a lot of water trying to get through a pipe that's too small. And so it really addresses the urgency for us to, you know, adjust our infrastructure as we kind of move forward with climate change.
The park is likely going to look a lot different in 50 years.
In 50 years, it's possible that some of our tree species may shift. Over the past 6 years, we lost all of our red pine to an invasive insect pest, the red pine scale. And so we know, you know, that happened very quickly. So it shows that change can happen fast. We know that we just got hemlock woolly adelgid into the park, which is an invasive insect that can damage hemlock trees. And it's possible if that spreads that, you know, we could lose a lot of our hemlocks over the near future. And we're concerned about other invasive pests as well. And so it's hard to know exactly how quickly or how slowly things will change, but things will be changing.
These challenges are not unique to Acadia, and park officials can't handle them alone.
The National Park Service can't do this on our own. We really have to work with conservation partners like Skudik Institute, like Friends of Acadia, like Maine Coast Heritage Trust. It's a big challenge, and it's happening at all national parks across the country and honestly across the world. So this is not unique to Acadia. People, visitors, listeners can participate, can help. So there are ways you can help. You can help by reducing your carbon footprint to help slow climate change. You can help by getting involved in community efforts. And you can help by getting involved with citizen science. So doing the science that helps us understand how things are changing, how we might respond to those changes. So apps like that anybody can pick up, like iNaturalist or eBird or Nature's Notebook, are apps that national parks across the country and scientists around the world use data collected by those things. And so those are easy ways that people can contribute in real valuable ways to helping us respond to climate change.
What the park will look like in 100 years isn't certain, but it will definitely be changed.
Even though things have changed dramatically over the past 100 years, the postcards kind of look the same still. By and large, you still see our spruce fir on the rocky coast. But, you know, in 50 or 80 or 100 years, the postcards will look different when those spruce and fir disappear and we have more deciduous trees. The coastline will look really different, and that'll affect a lot of the park.
If you're one of the 3.5 million people like to have visited Acadia this year, or even if you're not, there are things you can do to help.
Stay on the trails and don't squash the plants,
that's right? That's totally right. Yes. Another important message is to follow leave no trace principles in national parks. And there are a lot of sensitive habitats. So it's more important than ever to reduce your personal footprint on the park. Stay on trails, especially on our summits. Those habitats are particularly sensitive, and they will almost certainly provide refugia for species going forward. So those summits and our coastal areas, which are some of our most vulnerable areas to trampling and things, but we expect the climate to change more slowly in those places. And so they will likely provide refugia for species and allow them to hold on in the park for longer as we do the science to figure out how we can help transition to those species potentially to other locations further north or elsewhere, or they naturally get there. So those, you know, protecting those areas is really important.
Thank you for listening to the weekly podcast. We'll be taking a holiday break, but we'll be back again with new episodes in January. In the meantime, feel free to listen to some of our previous episodes from our first season. You can find The Weekly wherever fine podcasts are downloaded or visit one of our news websites. The Weekly is a collaboration between the Ellsworth American, Courier Gazette, Republican Journal, Camden Herald, and Mount Desert Islander, all powered by Village Soup. If you have a comment or suggestion for someone we should talk to, send us an email at theweekly@villagesoup.com. Until next time.